The loonies are in full bloom tonight.
I offered him some stewed mutton, said the old woman by the fire without turning. But no, he has to have his frogs and cow pies. Right fussy eater for a naked nutter.
Pocket, said Leah, clawing at my arm. Who is that large naked chap?
He calls himself Tom, Nuncle. Says he's pursued by the devil.
He must have daughters. See here, Tom. Did you give all to your daughters? Is that what drove you mad and poor, even until you are naked?
Tom crawled across the floor until he was at Leah's side.
I was a vain and selfish servant, said the nutter. I slept with my mistress every night and woke thinking of putting it to her again in the morning. I drank and caroused and made merry, even while my half-brother fought a crusade for a church for which he held no faith. I took all without thought for those who had nothing. Now I have nothing. Not a stitch, not a crumb, not a coin, and the devil dogs me to the ends of the earth for my selfishness.
You see, said Leah, only a man's cruel daughters could drive him to such a state.
He didn't say that, you daft geezer. He said he was a selfish libertine and the devil took his kit. The old woman turned now.
Aye, the fool's right. The younger nutter has no daughters. 'Tis his own unkindness that curses him.
She crossed the cabin with two steaming bowls of stew and set them before us on the floor.
And it's your own evil hounds you, Leah, not your daughters.
The old woman. I'd seen her before. She was one of the crones from the Great Burnham Wood. Different togs and somewhat less green, but this was surely Rosemary, the cat-toad witch. Leah slid to the floor and grabbed poor Tom's hand.
I have been selfish. I have thought nothing of the weight of my deeds. My own father I imprisoned in the temple at Bath because he was a leper, and later had him killed. My own brother I did murder when I suspected him of bedding my queen. No trial, not even the honour of a challenge. I had him murdered in his sleep without proof. And my queen is dead, too, for my jealousy. My kingdom is the fruit of treachery, and treachery have I reaped. I do not deserve to even wear clothes on my back. You are true, Tom, that you have nothing. I, too, shall have nothing, as is my just reward.
The old man began to tear off his clothes, ripping at the collar of his shirt, tearing more of his parchment-like skin than the linen. I stayed his hand, held his wrists, and tried to catch his eye with my own, to pull him back from madness.
"Oh, I have wronged my sweet Cordelia,"
the old man wailed.
"The only one who loved me, and I have wronged her, my one true daughter. Gods, tear these clothes from my back, tear the meat from my bones."
Then I felt claws clamp on my own wrists, and I was pulled away from Leah as if I'd been drawn by heavy iron shackles.
"Let him suffer," hissed the witch in my ear.
"But I have made this pain," said I.
"Leah's pain is of his own making, fool," she said.
With that, I felt the room spinning, and I heard the voice of the girl ghost telling me to sleep.
"Sleep, sweet Pocket."
"Who's the muddy naked bloke snogging the king's noggin?" asked Kent.
I awoke to see the old knight standing in the doorway with the Earl of Gloucester. The storm still raged outside, but by firelight I could see the naked nutter, Tom of Bedlam, had wrapped himself around Leah and was kissing the king's bald head as if blessing a newborn babe.
"Oh, Majesty," said Gloucester, "can't you find better company than this? Who is this rough beast?"
"He's a philosopher," said Leah. "I will talk with him."
"Poor Tom of Bedlam, is he?" said Tom. "Eater of tadpoles, cursed and damned by demons."
Kent looked to me, and I shrugged. "Both mad as cat herds," said I. I looked around for the old woman as a witness, but she was gone.
"Well, snap to, Majesty. I bring news from France," said Kent.
"Hollandaise sauce excellent on eggs?" I inquired.
"No," said Kent, "more urgent."
"Wine and cheese complement one another nicely," I further queried. No, you rasp-tongued rascal.
France has landed an army at Dover, and there's rumour they've forces hidden in other cities around the British coast, ready to strike.
Oh, well, that does trump the wine and cheese news then, doesn't it?
Gloucester was trying to pry Tom off King Lear, but having a hard time doing so while keeping mud off his cloak.
I've sent word to the French camp at Dover that Lear is here, said Gloucester. I've made the case to the king's daughters to let me bring him in from the storm, but they will not relent. Even in my own home my power has been usurped by the Duke of Cornwall. Regan and Cornwall have taken command of Lear's knights, and with them, my castle.
We come to bring you to a hovel at the city wall, said Kent.
When the storm breaks, Gloucester will send a cart to take Lear to the French camp at Dover.
No, said Lear. Let me talk to my philosopher friend in private.
He pawed at Mad Tom.
He knows much of how life should be lived. Tell me, friend, why is there thunder?
Kent turned to Gloucester and shrugged.
He's not in his right mind.
Who can blame him, said Gloucester. After what his daughters have done, his very flesh rising up against him, I had a beloved son who conspired to murder me, and just the thought of that nearly drove me mad.
Do you nobles have any reaction to hardship besides going bloody barking and running off to eat dirt, said I.
Hitch up your bollocks and get on with it, would you?
Caius, what of Drool?
I left him hidden in the laundry, but Edmund will find him when his mind turns full to the task. Right now he is distracted by trying to avoid the sisters and conspiring with Cornwall.
My son, Edmund, he is still true, said Gloucester.
Yes, right, my lord, said I. And mind you don't trip on the honeysuckle sprouting from his bum when you next see him. Do you have means to get me into the castle without Edmund knowing I'm there?
I suppose.
But I take no commands from you, fool. You are but a slave, and an impudent one at that.
You're still angry over my jesting about your dead wife, aren't you?
Do the fool's will, boomed Lear. His word is as mine.
A slight breeze then would have knocked me off my feet, so shocked was I.
Oh, there was still madness glowing in the old man's eyes,
but so was the fire of his authority. A feeble, babbling wretch one moment, the next a dragon deep inside the old man barked fire.
Yes, your majesty, said Gloucester.
He's a good lad, said Kent, by way of easing the bite of Lear's command. Nuncle, bring your naked madman and let us go with Gloucester to this hovel by the city wall. I'll retrieve my nitwit apprentice from the castle, and off we'll be to meet up with the bloody Frog King Jeff at Dover. Kent rubbed my shoulder.
A sword in support, then?
No, thank you, said I. You stay with the old man. Get him to Dover. I pulled Kent over by the fire and bade him bend down so I could whisper in his ear.
Did you know that Lear murdered his brother?
The old knight's eyes went wide, then narrowed as if he were in pain.
He gave the order.
Oh, Kent, thou loyal old fool.
Kitten's Claws. We entered Castle Gloucester in stealth, which does not suit me, as you might guess. I am better suited to entering a room with a series of somersaults, a clackstick, rude noise, and a top of the morning to your tossers. I'm fitted out in bells and puppets, for fuck's sake. All this sneaking and subterfuge was wearing on me. I followed the Earl of Gloucester through a secret hatch in the stable and into a tunnel that passed under the moat. We waded through a foot of cold water in the dark, making for a slosh in my step as well as a jingle. I'd never fit Drool through the narrow passage, even if I could chase the dark with a torch. The tunnel opened through another hatch in the floor of a dungeon. The Earl took his leave in the very torture chamber where I had met Regan. I'm off to arrange the passage for your master to Dover, fool. I still have a few servants who are true to me. I felt indebted to the old man for helping me into the castle, especially given his former bitterness toward me. Steer clear of the bastard, your grace. I know he is your favoured son, but not rightly so. He's a villain. Don't disparage Edmund, fool. I know your conniving ways. Only last evening he stood with me in protest against Cornwall's treatment of the king. I could tell Gloucester about the letter I'd forged in Edgar's hand, about the bastard's plan to usurp his brother, but what could he do? Likely he'd storm into Edmund's quarters and the bastard would murder him on the spot. Right then, said I. Be careful, my lord. Cornwall and Regan are a four-fanged viper, and if they should turn their venom on Edmund, you must let him go. Do not come to his aid, lest you, too, are scratched with poisonous pricks. My last true son, shame on you, fool, said the Earl. He scoffed and hurried out of the dungeon and up the stairs. I thought to prevail upon one god or another to protect the old man, but if the gods were working in my favour, they would continue unbidden, and if they opposed, there was no need to alert them to my cause. It pained me, but I took off my shoes and hat and tucked them into my jerkin to still the bells. Jones had remained back at the hovel with Leah. The laundry lay in the lower levels of the castle, so I made my way there first. The laundress with the aforementioned knockers of the smashing persuasion was hanging a basket load of shirts by the fire when I entered. "Where's Drool, love?" I asked. "Hidden," she said. "I know he's bloody hidden, otherwise asking would have been superfluous, wouldn't it?"
"Just want me to give him up, then? How do I know you're not out to kill him? The old knight who brought him here said not to let anyone know where he was."
"But I'm here to get him out of the castle, rescue him, as it were."
"Aye, you say that, but..."
"Listen, you bloody tart, give up the git."
"Emma,"
said the laundress. I sat down on the hearth and rested my head in my hands. "Love, I've spent the night in a storm with a witch and two raving nutters. I've a brace of wars to see to, as well as the summary violation of two princesses and consequent cuckolding of a pair of dukes. I'm heartbroken, aggrieved for the loss of a friend, and the great drooling lummox that is my apprentice is evidently wandering the castle in search of a mortal chest wound. Pity a fool, love. Another non sequitur may dash my brittle sanity to splinters."
"My name is Emma," said the laundress.
"I'm right here, Pocket,"
said Drool, standing up in the great cauldron. A pile of laundry on his head had been concealing his great empty melon as he lurked in the water.
"Knocker's hided me. She's a love."
"You see," said Emma. "He keeps calling me knockers."
"It's a compliment, love."
"It's disrespectful," she said. "My name's Emma."
I will never understand women. The laundress, it would seem, dressed in a manner that accentuated, indeed celebrated, her bosoms. A tightly cinched waist pushing bits up until they bloomed out of a swooping neckline. Yet a chap notices and a lady takes offence. I will never understand it. "You know he's a complete nitwit, don't you, Emma?"
"Just the same."
"Fine. Drool, apologise to Emma for saying how smashing a knockers are."
"Sorry about your knockers,"
said Drool, bowing his head so his laundry hat dropped back into the drink.
"Satisfied, Emma?" I asked. "I suppose."
"Good. Now, do you know where Captain Curran, the commander of King Lear's knights, might be?"
"Oh, yes," said Emma. "Lord Edmund and the Duke consulted me this morning on all the military matters, as they are wont to do, me being a laundress and having access to all the best bloody tactics and strategies in the lot."
"Sarcasm will make your tits fall off," said I.
"Will not,"
she said, her arm going to a support position. "It's a known fact," I said, nodding earnestly, then looking to Drool, who also nodded earnestly and said, "It's a known fact," note for note in my voice.
"That's bloody spooky," Emma shuddered. "You lot can get out of my laundry."
"Very well, then," said I. I motioned for Drool to climb out of the cauldron. "I thank you for looking after the natural, Emma. I wish there was something I could..."
"Kill Edmund," she said.
"Pardon?"
"The son of a guild builder were going to marry me before I came to work here. A respected man. Edmund took me against my will and bragged about it in the village. My lad wouldn't have me then. No one worth his salt will have me, except the bastard, and him whenever he wants. 'Tis Edmund who commanded that I wear this low frock. Says he'll set me out with the pigs if I don't give him service. Kill him for me.
But, lass, I'm just a fool, a clown, a small one at that.
There's more to you than that, you black-hatted rascal. I've seen them wicked daggers at your back, and I can see who's pulling the strings round this castle, and it ain't the Duke or the old king. Kill the bastard.
Edmund beated me, said Drool, and she do have smashing knockers.
Drool!
Well, she do.
All right, then, said I, taking the laundress's hand. But in time, we've things to accomplish first. I bowed over her hand, kissed it, then turned on my heel and padded barefoot out of the laundry to set history.
Heinous fuckery,
Drool whispered to the laundress with a wink. I hid Drool in the gatehouse among the heavy chains that I had used for my escape when I pursued Lear into the storm. Getting the lummox up on the wall and to the gatehouse undetected was no small task, and he left a dripping trail on the stones until we gained the castle exterior. But the guard was light in the tempest, so most of the way we went across the top of the walls unseen. My feet felt as if they'd been set in ice by the time I came back into a fire, but there was no other way. Drool in the tight space of the secret tunnel, with his fear of the dark, was not something I would wish on an enemy. I found a woolen blanket and wrapped the lout in it to await my return. Guard my shoes and satchel, Drool. I made my way, dodging from nook to cranny through the kitchen to the servants' entrance into the great hall, hoping I might get a moment with Regan there. The hall's massive fireplace would be an enticement for the princess on such a frigid day. For as much as she took to the activities of a dungeon, she was drawn to heat like a cat. Because Castle Gloucester had no curtain wall, even the great hall was fitted with arrow loops, so the edifice might be defended at all levels from an attack by water. The arrow loops, while shuttered, were notoriously drafty, so arrases were hung over the alcoves against the wind. The perfect place for a fool to watch, warm himself, and find his moment. I slipped into the room behind a brace of serving girls and into the alcove nearest the fireplace. She was there, by the fire, in a heavy hooded black fur robe, only her face revealed to the world. I pulled the tapestry aside and was about to call her when the latch was thrown on the hall's main doors and the Duke of Cornwall entered, wearing his usual finery with the red lion crest on his chest, but more pointedly, Leah's crown, the one the old man had thrown on the table that fateful night at the White Tower. Even Regan seemed startled to see it on the head of her husband.
"My lord, is it prudent to wear the crown of Britain when our sister is still in the castle?"
"Right, right. We must keep up appearances, as if we don't know that Albany raises an army against us." Cornwall took the crown off and hid it under a cushion by the hearth. "I am to meet Edmund here and lay a plan for the Duke's undoing. One hopes that your sister can be kept out of harm's way."
Regan shrugged. "If she throws herself under Destiny's hooves, who are we to save her brains from being pulped?" Cornwall took her in his arms and kissed her passionately.
"Oh, lady," thought I, "push him away lest you debase your lovely lips with villainy." Then it occurred to me, and perhaps rather later than it should have, that she would no more taste villainy than a garlic-eater will taste the stinking rose on another. The lady had evil on her breath already. Even as the Duke held her tight and professed his adoration of her, she wiped her mouth on her sleeve behind his back. She pushed the Duke away when the bastard Edmund entered the hall.
"My lord," said Edmund, only nodding to Regan. "Our plans for Albany must be delayed. Look at this letter."
The Duke took the parchment from Edmund.
"What?" said Regan. "What? What? What?"
"France has landed forces. He knows of unrest between ourselves and Albany and has hidden forces in coastal cities all over Britain."
Regan snatched the parchment out of Cornwall's hand and read it for herself.
"This is addressed to Gloucester."
Edmund bowed in false contrition.
"Aye, milady, I found it in his closet and brought it here as soon as I saw its contents. Guard, called Cornwall. The great doors opened and a soldier looked in. Bring me the Earl of Gloucester. Give no deference to his title. He is a traitor.
I looked for a way back to the kitchen, to perhaps find Gloucester and warn him of the bastard's treachery. But Edmund faced the alcove where I was hiding, and there was no getting out undiscovered. I opened the shutter to the arrow loop. Even if I could manage to wiggle through it, the wall was a sheer drop to the lake below. I palmed the shutter closed and latched it. The latch on the main doors clanked again, and I returned to the gap between the wall and the tapestry, from which I saw Goneril enter, trailed by two soldiers who held Gloucester by the arms. The old man looked as if he'd given up already, and hung between the soldiers like a drowned man.
"Hang him!" said Regan, turning to warm her hands by the fire. "What is this?"
said Goneril.
Cornwall handed her the letter, and stood looking over her shoulder while she read.
"Pluck out his eyes," she said, making an effort not to look at Gloucester.
Cornwall took the letter gently from her hand and put his hand on her shoulder in brotherly support.
"Leave him to our displeasure, sister. Edmund, keep our sister company and see her safely home. Lady, tell your duke we must unite against this foreign force. We'll send dispatches quickly between us. Go now, Earl of Gloucester. You do not want to see the dealings with this traitor."
Edmund couldn't conceal a smile upon being addressed by the title he had lusted after for so many years.
"I will," said Edmund.
He offered his arm to Goneril, who took it. They started out of the hall.
"No,"
said Regan. Everyone stopped. Cornwall stepped between Regan and her sister.
"Lady, now is the time when we must all be united against the foreign power."
Regan gritted her teeth and turned back to the fire, waving them away.
"Go!"
Edmund and Goneril left the hall.
"Bind him to that chair, then leave us," Cornwall commanded his soldiers.
They tied the old earl to a heavy chair and stood back.
"You are my guests," said Gloucester. "Do me no foul play."
"Filthy traitor," said Regan.
She took the letter from her husband and threw it in the old man's face. She grabbed a pinch of Gloucester's beard and yanked it out. The earl yowled.
"So white, and such a traitor," she said.
"I am no traitor. I am loyal to my king."
She pulled another pinch from his beard.
"What letters do you have late from France? What is their plan?"
Gloucester looked at the parchment on the floor.
"I have only that."
Cornwall charged up to Gloucester and pulled the old man's head back by the back of his hair.
"Speak now. To whose hands have you sent the lunatic king? We know you've sent him aid."
"To Dover. I sent him to Dover.
Only a few hours ago."
"Why Dover?" said Regan.
"Because I would not see your cruel nails pluck out his old eyes, or your sister tear his flesh with her boorish fangs. Because there are those who would care for him there, not put him out in the storm."
"He lies," said Regan. "There's a smashing torture chamber in the dungeon. Shall we?"
But Cornwall would not wait. In a second, he was sitting astraddle the old man and was digging his thumb into Gloucester's eye socket. Gloucester screamed until his voice broke and there was a sickening pop. I reached for one of my throwing daggers. The main door to the hall cracked and heads popped up at the stairwell from the kitchen.
"Why Dover?" said Regan.
"Thou carrion bird," said Gloucester with a cough.
"Thou she-devil. I'll not say."
"Then you'll not see light again," said Cornwall, and he was on the old man again. I would not have it. I drew back my dagger to cast it, but before I could, a band like ice encircled my wrist, and I looked to see the girl ghost right beside me, staying my throw, in fact, paralyzing me. I could only move my eyes to look back on the horror playing out in the great hall.
Suddenly, a boy brandishing a long butcher knife ran out of the kitchen stairwell and leapt on the Duke. Cornwall stood and tried to draw his sword, but could not get it clear of the scabbard before the boy was on him, plunging the knife into his side. As the lad pulled back to stab again, Regan drew a dagger from the sleeve of her robe and plunged it into the boy's neck, then stepped back from the spray of blood. The boy clawed at his neck and fell. "Away!" Regan shrieked, waving the dagger at the servants in the kitchen stairwell and the main door, and they all disappeared like frightened mice. Cornwall climbed unsteadily to his feet and plunged his sword into the boy's heart. Then he sheathed his sword and felt his side. His hand came away bloody.
"Serves you right, you scurvy vermin," said Gloucester.
With that, Cornwall was on him again.
"Out, foul jelly!"
he shouted, digging his thumb into the Earl's good eye. But in that instant, Regan's dagger snapped down and took the eye.
"Don't trouble yourself, my lord."
Gloucester passed out then from the pain and hung limp in his bonds. Cornwall stood and kicked the old man's chest, knocking him over backward. The Duke looked on Regan with adoring eyes, filled with the warmth and affection that can only come from watching your wife dirk another man's eye out on your behalf, evidently.
"Your wound?" said Regan.
Cornwall held his arm out to his wife, and she walked into his embrace. "It glanced across my ribs. I'll bleed some, and it pains me, but if bound, it'll not be mortal."
"Pity,"
said Regan, and she plunged her dagger under his sternum, and held it as his heart's blood poured over her snowy white hand.
The Duke seemed somewhat surprised.
"Bugger," he said. Then he fell. Regan wiped her dagger and her hands on his tunic. She sheathed the blade in her sleeve, then went to the cushion where Cornwall had hidden her father's crown, pulled back her hood, and fitted it on her head.
"Well, Pocket?"
said the Duchess, without turning to the alcove where I was hidden.
"How does it fit?"
I was somewhat surprised, although somewhat less so than the Duke. The ghost released me then, and I stood behind the tapestry, my knife still poised for the throw.
"You'll grow into it, kitten," said I.
She looked to my alcove and grinned.
"Yes, I will, won't I? Did you want something?"
"Let the old man go," I said. "King Geoff of France has landed his army at Dover. That's why Gloucester sent Lear there. You'd be wise to set a camp farther south. Rally your forces with Edmunds and Albany's at the White Tower, perhaps." The great doors creaked and a head peeked in, a helmeted soldier.
"Send for a physician,"
Regan called, trying to sound distressed.
"My lord has been wounded. Throw his attacker on the dung heap and cast this traitor out the front gate. He can smell his way to Dover and his decrepit king."
In a moment, the chamber was filled with soldiers and servants, and Regan walked out, casting one last look and a sly smile to my hiding place. I have no idea why she left me alive. I suspect it's because she still fancied me. I slipped out through the kitchen and made my way back to the gatehouse. The ghost stood over Drool, who was cowering under his blanket in the corner.
"Come on, you lovely brute. Give us a proper snog."
"Leave him be, Wisp," said I, although she was nearly as solid as a mortal woman.
"Balls up your jaunty murdering for the day, did I, fool?"
"I might have saved the old man's second eye."
"You wouldn't have."
"I might have sent Regan to join a duke in whatever hell he inhabits."
"No, you wouldn't have."
Then she held up a ghostly finger, cleared her throat, and rhymed.
"When a second sibling's base derision proffers lies that cloud the vision, and severs ties that families bind, shall a madman rise to lead the blind?"
"You've said that one already."
"I know. Bit prematurely, too. Sorry. I think you'll find it much more relevant now. Even a slow git like yourself can solve the riddle now, I reckon.
Or you could just fucking tell me what it means, said I.
Sorry, can't do it. Ghostly mystery and whatnot. Ta.
And with that, she faded away through the stone wall.
I didn't shag the ghost, Pocket,
wailed Drool.
I didn't shag her.
I know, lad. She's gone. Get up now. We've got to monkey down the drawbridge chains and find a blind earl. XIX. Shall a madman rise? Gloucester was wandering around outside the castle, just beyond the drawbridge, coming dangerously close to tumbling into the moat. The storm was still raging, and bloody rain streamed down the Earl's face from his empty eye sockets. Drool caught the old man by the back of his cloak and lifted him like he was a kitten. Gloucester struggled and waved about in horror, as if he'd been snatched up by some great bird of prey instead of an enormous nitwit.
"There, there," said Drool, trying to calm the old man the way one might try to settle a frightened horse.
"I got you."
"Bring him away from the edge and set him down, Drool," said I. "Lord Gloucester, this is Pocket, Lear's fool. We're going to take you to shelter and bandage your wounds. King Lear will be there too. Just take Drool's hand."
"Get away," said the Earl. "Your comforts are in vain. I am lost. My sons are scoundrels. My estate is forfeit. Let me fall into the moat and drown."
Drool set the old man down and pointed him toward the moat.
"Go on, then, my lord."
"Grab him, Drool, you wooden-headed ninny."
"But he told me to let him drown, and he's an earl with a castle and a lot, and you're only a fool, Pocket, so I gotta do what he says."
I strode forth, grabbed Gloucester and led him away from the edge. "He's not an earl any more, lad. He has nothing but his cloak to protect him from the rain, like us."
"He's got nothing," said Drool. "Can I teach him to juggle so he can be a fool?"
"Let's get him to shelter and see that he doesn't bleed to death first. Then you can give him fool lessons."
"We're going to make a fool of you," said Drool,
clapping the old man on the back.
"That'll be the dog's bollocks, won't it, my lord?"
"Drown me," said Gloucester. "Being a fool is ever so much better than being an earl," said Drool,
far too cheery for a cold, dismal day of post-maiming.
"You don't get a castle, but you make people laugh and they give you apples. And sometimes one of the wenches or the sheeps will have a laugh with you. It's the mutt's nuts, it is."
I stopped and looked at my apprentice. "You've been having a laugh with sheep?" Drool rolled his eyes towards the slate sky.
"No, we have pie sometimes too when Bubble makes it. You like Bubble? She's smashing."
Gloucester seemed to lose all his will then, and let me lead him through the walled town, taking weak, halting steps. As we passed a long, half-timbered building I took to be barracks, I heard someone call my name. I looked to see Curran, Lear's captain, standing under an awning. He waved us over and we stood with our backs hard to the wall to try to escape the rain.
"Is that the Earl of Gloucester?" asked Curran.
"Aye," said I. I told Curran what had transpired inside the castle and out on the heath since I'd last seen him. "God's blood! 2 wars? Cornwall dead? Who is our master of force now?"
"Mistress," said I.
"Stay with Regan. The plan is as before."
"No, it's not. We don't even know who her enemy is, Albany or France."
"Aye, but your action should be the same."
"I'd give a month's wages to be behind the blade that slays that bastard Edmund."
At the mention of his son, Gloucester started wailing again.
"Drown me. I will suffer no more. Give me your sword that I may run upon it and end my shame and misery."
"Sorry," I said to Curran. "He's been a bit of a weepy little Nancy to be around since they ripped his eyes out." Well, you might bandage him up. Bring him in. Hunter's still with us. He's right handy with the cauterizing iron.
Let me end this suffering, wailed Gloucester. I can no longer endure the slings and arrows.
My Lord Gloucester, would you please, by the fire-charred balls of St. George, shut the fuck up?
Bit harsh, innit? Said Curran.
What? I said please.
Still.
Sorry, Gloucester, old chap. Most excellent hat.
He's not wearing a hat, said Curran.
Well, he's blind, isn't he? If you hadn't said anything, he might have enjoyed his bloody hat, mightn't he?
The Earl started wailing again. My sons are villains, and I have no hat.
He meant to go on, but Drool clamped his great paw over the old man's mouth. Thanks, lad. Curran, do you have any food?
Aye, Pocket. We can spare as much bread and cheese as you can carry, and one of the men can scare up a flask of wine too, I'll wager. His lordship has been most generous in providing us with fare, Curran said, for the benefit of Gloucester. The old man began struggling against Drool's grip.
Oh, Curran, you've set him off again. Hurry, if you please. We've got to find Lear and head to Dover.
Dover it is, then. You'll join with France.
Aye, bloody King Jeff, great froggy, monkey-named woman-stealing ponce that he is. You're fond of him, then? Oh, do piss off, Captain. Just see to it that whatever force Regan might send after us doesn't catch us. Don't mutiny, just make your way to Dover east, then south. I'll take Lear south, then east.
Let me come with you, Pocket. The king needs more protection than two fools and a blind man.
The old knight Caius is with the king. You will serve the king best by serving his plan here.
Not strictly true. But would he have done his duty if he thought his commander a fool?
I think not.
Aye, then. I'll get you food, said Curran.
When we arrived at the hovel, Tom of Bedlam stood outside, naked in the rain, barking.
That barking bloke is naked, said Drool,
for once not singing praise to St. Obvious, as we were actually travelling with a blind fellow.
Aye, but the question is he naked because he's barking, or is he barking because he's naked? I asked.
I'm hungry,
said Drool, his mind over-challenged.
Poor Tom is cold and cursed, said Tom, between barking fits, and for the first time seeing him in daylight and mostly clean, I was taken aback.
Without the coat of mud, Tom looked familiar, very familiar. Tom of Bedlam was, in fact, Edgar of Gloucester, the Earl's legitimate son.
Tom, why are you out here?
Poor Tom. That old knight Caius said he had to stand in the rain until he was clean and didn't stink any more.
And did he tell you to bark and talk about yourself in the third person?
No, I thought up that bit on my own.
Come inside, Tom. Help Drool with this old fellow.
Tom looked at Gloucester for the first time, and his eyes went wide, and he sank to his knees.
By the cruelty of the gods, said he. He's blind.
I put my hand on his shoulder and whispered, Be steadfast, Edgar. Your father needs your help. In that moment, a light came into his eye like a spark of sanity returning, and he nodded and stood up, taking the Earl's arm. Shall a madman rise to lead the blind?
Come, good sir, said Edgar. Tom is mad, but he is not beyond aiding a stranger in distress. Just let me die, said Gloucester, trying to push Edgar away. Give me a rope so I may stretch my neck until my breath is gone.
He does that a lot, I said.
I opened the door, expecting to see Lear and Kent inside, but the hovel was empty and the fire had died down to embers.
Tom, where is the king?
He and his knight set out for Dover.
Without me?
The king was mad to be back in the storm. 'Twas the old knight said to tell you they were headed for Dover.
Here, bring the Earl inside.
I stood aside and let Edgar coax his father into the cabin. Drool, throw some wood on the fire.
We can stay only long enough to eat and dry out. We must be after the king. Drool looked up through the door and spotted Jones, sitting on a bench by the fire where I had left him.
"Jones, my friend," said the dolt.
He picked up the puppet stick and hugged it. Drool is somewhat unclear on the art of ventriloquism, and although I've explained to him that Jones speaks only through me, he has developed an attachment to the puppet.
"Hello, Drool, you great sawdust-brained buffoon. Put me down and stoke the fire," said Jones.
Drool tucked the puppet stick in his belt and began breaking up kindling with a hatchet by the hearth while I portioned out the bread and cheese that Curran had given us. Edgar did his best to bandage Gloucester's eyes, and the old man settled down enough to eat some cheese and drink a little wine. Unfortunately, the wine, and the blood loss, no doubt, took the Earl from inconsolable wailing grief to a soul-smothering, sable-coloured melancholy.
"My wife died, thinking me a whoremonger. My father thought me damned for not following his faith, and my sons are both villains. I thought for a term that Edmund might have redeemed his bastardy by being good and true, by fighting infidels in the Crusade. But he is more of a traitor than his legitimate brother."
"Edgar is no traitor," I said to the old man. Even as I said it, Edgar held a finger to his lips and signalled for me to speak no further. I nodded to show I knew his will and would not give his identity away. He could be Tom as long as he wished, or for as long as he needed, for all I cared. As long as he put on some bloody trousers.
"Edgar was always true to you, my lord. His treachery was all devised for your eyes by the bastard Edmund. It was two sons' worth of evil done by one. Edgar may not be the sharpest arrow in the quiver, but he is no traitor."
Edgar raised an eyebrow to me in question.
"You make no case for your intelligence, sitting there naked and shivering when there's a fire and blankets you can fashion into warm robes, good Tom," said I. He rose from his father's side and went over to the fire.
"Then it is I who have betrayed Edgar," said Gloucester. "Oh, the gods have seen fit to rain misery down on me for my unsteady heart. I have sent a good son into exile with hounds at his heels and left only the worms as heirs to my only estate. This withered, blind body. No, we are but soft and squishy bags of mortality rolling in a bin of sharp circumstance, leaking life until we collapse, flaccid into our own despair."
The old man began to wave his arms and beat at his brow, whipping himself into a frenzy, causing his bandages to unravel. Drool came over to the old man and wrapped his arms around him to hold him steady.
"It's all right, my lord," said Drool. "You ain't leaking hardly at all."
"Let me send this broken house to ruin and rot in death's eternal cold. Let me shuffle off this mortal coil. My son's betrayed, my king usurped, my estate seized. Let me end this torture."
He really was making a very good argument. Then the Earl grabbed Jones and tore him out of Drool's belt.
"Give me your sword, good knight."
Edgar made to stop his father, and I threw out an arm to hold him back. A toss of my head stopped Drool from interceding. The old man stood, put the stick end of Jones under his ribcage, then fell forward onto the dirt floor. The breath shot from his body, and he wheezed in pain. My cup of wine had been warming by the fire, and I threw it on Gloucester's chest.
"I am slain," croaked the Earl, fighting for breath. "The life-blood runs from me even now. Bury my body on the hill, looking down upon Castle Gloucester, and beg forgiveness of my son Edgar. I have wronged him."
Edgar again tried to go to his father, and I held him back. Drool was covering his mouth, trying not to laugh.
"I grow cold. Cold. But at least I take my wrongdoings to my grave."
"You know, my lord," I said, "the evil that men do lives after them, the good is oft interred with their bones, or so I've heard.
Edgar, my boy, wherever you are, forgive me. Forgive me.
The old man rolled on the floor and seemed somewhat surprised when the sword on which he thought himself impaled fell away.
Lear, forgive me that I did not serve you better.
Look at that, said I. You can see his black soul rising from his body.
Where?
Said Drool. A frantic finger to my lips silenced the natural.
Oh, great carrion birds are rending poor Gloucester's soul to tatters. Oh, fate's revenge is upon him. He suffers. I suffer, said Gloucester.
He is bound to the darkest depths of Hades, never to rise again.
Down the abyss I go, forever a stranger to light and warmth. Oh, cold and lonely death has taken him, said I. And a right shit he was in life. Likely he'll be buggered by a billion barb-dicked devils now.
Cold and lonely death has me, said the Earl.
No, it hasn't, said I.
What?
You're not dead.
Soon, then. I've fallen on this cruel blade and my life runs wet and sticky between my fingers.
You've fallen on a puppet, said I.
No,
I haven't.
It's a sword. I took it from that soldier.
You took my puppet stick from my apprentice. You've thrown yourself on a puppet.
You knave, Pocket. You're not trustworthy and would jest at a man even as his life drains. Where is that naked madman who was helping me?
You threw yourself on a puppet, said Edgar.
So I'm not dead?
Correct, said I.
I threw myself on a puppet.
That's what I've been saying.
You're a wicked little man, Pocket.
So, my lord, how do you feel now that you've returned from the dead? The old man stood up and tasted the wine on his fingers.
Better, said he.
Good. Then let me present Edgar of Gloucester, the erstwhile naked nutter, who shall see you to Dover and your king.
Hello, father, said Edgar.
They embraced. There was crying and begging for forgiveness and filial snogging, and overall the whole business was somewhat nauseating. A moment of quiet sobbing by the two men passed before the Earl resumed his wailing.
Oh, Edgar, I have wronged thee, and no forgiveness from you can undo my wretchedness.
Oh, for fuck's sake, said I. Come, Drool, let us go find Lear and on to Dover and the sanctuary of the bloody fucking French.
But the storm still rages, said Edgar.
I've been wandering in this storm for days. I'm as wet and cold as I know how to get, and no doubt a fever will descend any hour now and crush my delicate form with a heavy heat. But by the rug-munching balls of Sappho, I'll not spend another hour listening to a blind old nutter wail on about his wrongdoings when there's a stack of wrongs yet to be done. Carpe diem, Edgar, carpe diem.
Fish of the day,
said the rightful heir to the earldom of Gloucester.
Yes, that's it. I'm invoking the fish of the bloody day, you git.
I liked you better when you were eating frogs and seeing demons in the lot. Drool, leave them half the food and wrap yourself as warm as you can. We're off to find the king. We'll see you lot in Dover.
Act 4. As flies to wanton boys are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport.
King Lear, Act 4, Scene 1. Gloucester.
20. A pretty little thing.
Drool and I slogged through the cold rain for a day, across hill and dale, over unpaved heath and roads that were little more than muddy wheel ruts. Drool affected a jaunty aspect, remarkable considering the dark doings he had just escaped, but a light spirit is the blessing of the idiot. He took to singing and splashing gaily through puddles as we travelled. I was deeply burdened by wit and awareness, so I found sulking and grumbling better suited my mood. I regretted that I hadn't stolen horses, acquired oilskin cloaks, found a fire-making kit, and murdered Edmund before we left. The latter, among many reasons, because I could not ride upon Drool's shoulders, as his back was still raw from Edmund's beatings. Bastard. I should say here that after some days in the elements, the first I'd spent there since my time with Belette and the travelling mummer troupe many years ago, I determined that I'm an indoor fool. My lean form does not fend off cold well, and it seems no better at shedding water. I fear I am too absorbent to be an outdoor fool. My singing voice turns raspy in the cold, my japes and jokes lose their subtlety when cast against the wind, and when my muscles are slowed by an unkind chill, even my juggling is shit. I am untempered for the tempest, unsuited for a storm. Better fit for fireplace and featherbed. Oh, warm wine, warm heart, warm tart, where art thou? Poor cold pocket. A drowned and wretched rat is he. We travelled in the dark for miles before we smelled meat smoke on the wind and spotted the orange light of an oil-skinned window in the distance.
Look, Pocket, a house, said Drool. We can sit by the fire and maybe have a warm supper.
We've no money, lad, and nothing to trade them.
We trade him a jest for our supper, like we done before.
I can think of nothing amusing to do, Drool. Tumbling is out of the question. My fingers are too stiff to work Jones's talk string, and I'm too weary even for the simple telling of a tale.
We could just ask them. They might be kind.
That's a blustery bag of tempest toss, isn't it?
They might, insisted the oaf. Bubble once give me a pie without I ever jested a thing. Just give it to me, out of the kindness of her heart.
Fine, fine. We shall prevail upon their kindness. But should that fail, prepare yourself to bash in their brains and take the supper by force.
What if there's a lot of them? Then you're going to help.
I shrugged and gestured to my fair form. Small and weary, lad. Small and weary. If I'm too weak to perform a puppet show, I think the brain-bashing duties will, by necessity, fall upon you. Find a sturdy stick of firewood. There. There's a woodpile over there.
I don't want to bash no brains, said the stubborn nitwit.
Fine. Here, take one of my daggers. I handed him a knife. Give a good dirking to anyone who requires it. At that point, the door opened, and a wizened form stepped into the doorway and raised a storm lantern.
Who goes there?
Begging pardon, sirrah, said Drool. We was wondering if you required a good dirking this evening.
Give that to me. I snatched the dagger away from the git and fitted it into the sheath at my back. Sorry, sir. The natural jest's out of turn. We're looking for some shelter from the storm and perhaps a hot meal. We've only bread and a little cheese, but we will share it for the shelter.
We are fools, said Drool.
Shut up, Drool. You can see that by my kit and your empty gaze.
Come in, pocket of dog snogging, said the bent figure. Mind your head on the door jamb, Drool.
We're buggered, said I, pushing Drool through the door ahead of me.
Witches three.
Parsley, sage and rosemary. Oh, no. Not in the great Burnham Wood, where they are generally kept, where one might fairly expect to encounter them, but here, in a warm cabin off the road between the Gloucestershire villages of Tossing Sod and Bongwater Crash. A flying house, perhaps? It's rumoured that witches are afraid of such structures.
I thought you was an old man, but you is an old woman,
said Drool to the hag who had let us in.
Sorry.
No proof, please, said I, afraid that one of the hags might confirm her gender by lifting her skirts. The lad's suffered enough of late.
Some stew,
said the crone, sage, the warty one. The small pot hung over the fire. I've seen what you put in your stew.
"Stew, stew, true and blue," said the tall witch, Parsley.
"Yes, please,"
said Drool. "It's not stew," said I. "They call it stew because it rhymes with bloody blue, but it's not stew."
"No, it's stew," said Rosemary. "Beef and carrots and a lot."
"Afraid it is," said Sage.
"Not bits of batwing, eye of lecher, sweetbreads of newt and a lot, then?"
"A few onions," said Parsley.
"That's it? No magical powers, no apparitions, no curse? You appear out here in the middle of nowhere, nay, on the very fringe of the tick's knickers that sucks the ass of nowhere, and you've no agenda except to feed the natural and me and give us a chance to chase the chill?"
"Aye, that's about it," said Rosemary.
"Why?"
"Couldn't think of nothing that rhymes with onions," said Sage. "Aye, we were right fucked for spell-casting once the onions went in," said Parsley. "Truth be told, beef put us against the wall, didn't it?" said Rosemary. "Yeah. Thief, I suppose," mused Sage, rolling her good eye toward the ceiling.
"And thief? Although, strictly speaking, that ain't a proper rhyme."
"Right," said Parsley. "No telling what kind of dodgy apparition you'll conjure. You cock up the rhyme like that. Thief, teeth, pathetic, really."
"Stew, please," said Drool.
I let the crones feed us. The stew was hot and rich and mercifully devoid of amphibian and corpse bits. We broke out the last of the bread Curran had given us, and shared it with the witches, who produced a jug of fortified wine and poured it for all. I warmed both inside and out, and for the first time in what seemed days, my clothes and shoes were dry.
"So, it's going well, then?" asked Sage, after we'd each had a couple of cups of wine.
I counted out calamities on my digits. Leah, stripped of his knights, civil war between his daughters, France has invaded, Duke of Cornwall murdered, Earl of Gloucester blinded, but reunited with his son, who's a raving loony, the sisters enchanted and in love with the bastard Edmund.
"I shagged 'em proper,"
added Drool.
Yes, Drool boffed them until both walked unsteady. And let's see. Leah wanders across the moors to find sanctuary with the French at Dover. Handfuls of happenings.
"Leah suffers, then?"
asked Parsley.
"Greatly," said I. "He's nothing left. A great height from which to fall, being..."